Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Fosler. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Major Jeff Lee moves for the appellant, Lance James Fosler. The court's permission, I have reserved 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted. You might want to raise the mic just a little bit there.
The specification here is deficient because it omits a statutory element of the offense and fails to provide adequate notice. And I'd like to talk about those 2 points in that order. First, the Supreme Court has always held that a charge must expressly allege every statutory element of an offense. Thus, because the terminal element is a statutory element, it has to be expressly alleged in the specification. But even if we look past that rule, the terminal element is not implied here because no word found in the specification means prejudice, good order, and discipline, or service discredit. As a result, because an element is missing under this court's precedence, the specification is fatally defective.
Well, under this court's precedence, we've repeatedly said you don't have to expressly allege it. Mayo, for instance. You're basically asking us to overrule a whole bunch of precedent, are you not?
Yes, Your Honor. But this court has already taken that first step in Medina, Miller, and Jones, where it recognized that the terminal element is not simply mere surplusage. And we point out that this court's predecessors never found that the terminal element was implied.
Now, we had some loose language, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying Rule 307 is bad law? Because it permits you to do it by implication?
No, Your Honor. It's not bad law. It can't...
You just said every element has to be expressly alleged.
Every statutory element, Your Honor. And what we look to is Resendez-Pons. And putting that in historical context, we know that prior to Resendez-Pons, in Cook and Carl, Almendarez-Torres and Hamling, all of these Supreme Court cases, they always found that you had to expressly allege every element of the offense. What Resendez-Pons did was where all the statutory elements were expressly alleged, their attempt is the key element. They found that the common law element, overt act, was necessarily implied because that's what attempt means. So here, when we look to the specification, there's simply no word there that means prejudice, good order, discipline, or service discredit. And we would point out that both the Second and Ninth Circuits have interpreted Resendez-Pons in the same way, that if the charge tracks the language of the charging statute, and some word of that tracked language encompasses an unexpressed element, the charge is sufficient. We just don't have that here. So RCM 307 is still good law.
It's good law if it necessarily implies the element. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. And where the only time it would necessarily imply...
Taking it in abstract, if there were such a provision, let's call it Article 1, and there was only one element in Article 1, if the government specification said in that you violated Article 1, would that necessarily cover the element by necessary implication?
We don't think so, Your Honor. Not under Hutchison and Delaware, where in Hutchison, the Supreme Court case in this court's...
And this is the hypothetical,
yes,
of course.
Yes, Your Honor.
But why wouldn't it necessarily reach the element if there was only one element?
Perhaps
they might not give you notice, Your Honor, of when the event occurred and all this other stuff. But let's say in that on a date certain, at a time certain, in a place certain, and all that, it did violate Article 1. And I think I can't understand what you're saying. You either have to expressly state the element or can you reach it by necessary implication. You said you can do it either way. So why wouldn't you necessarily reach by implication the element if there's only one element in that offense?
Your Honor, applying the Supreme Court precedent as it is, which is that you have to track the language of the charging statute and some word of that tracked language includes that unexpressed element, but we get there. Under your hypothetical, maybe because there's only one element and there could be no others and it would fall only under that particular statute, maybe the Supreme Court or this court could rule differently. But as it stands, we don't have that here. We have more than one element. And really what we've had over time is prosecutors and even the courts focusing on the first element, that is the act. And that's really become the focus, and this terminal element has shrunk so much over time that it's almost become irrelevant. And the circumstances, which this court in Miller said is part of the terminal element, are almost non-existent in terms of charging. And that brings us really quite quickly into the notice aspect of the argument, because the government insists that the terminal element is implied.
Counsel, before you leave that,
yes, sir.
I want to be clear on your position. It wasn't clear to me whether you were saying that RCM 307 permits an element to be found by necessary implication with respect to any aspect of the element, or that it can only be found by necessary implication with respect to an attempt based upon the Supreme Court decision. So what's your position on necessary implication under the rule?
Well, either way, Your Honor, we think we prevail here. First, if we look at attempt, and we kind of look to Justice Scalia's dissent there.
I wasn't asking you how you'll win. We can get to that. But what's the answer to my question? What's the position of the appellant with respect to the interpretation of RCM 307?
Can any element
be found by necessary implication, or does it only apply to attempts?
We think that it can be found in any beyond attempts, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But only in those situations where that word, replacing the element attempt with another element, that particular word, that element, encompasses necessarily, because it means that unexpressed element, then it could.
Okay. Then, in response to an earlier question, you agreed, apparently, that several of our precedents would need to be overruled. And these are the precedents cited by the Court of Criminal Appeals on page 7 of the slip opinion, starting with the Marker opinion in 1952, Sedinsky in 1964, Mayo in 1982. Under the standards that are applicable to stare decisis, what would be the basis, in your view, for overruling those opinions?
That law simply, whatever purpose it served then, Your Honor, if it did serve any at all, is no longer good law. More specifically, even when those cases came out, they were in direct conflict with Supreme Court precedent, namely Cook and Carr, that every element had to be expressly alleged. And we point out that whichever way this court rules, it's going to have to overturn some precedent, we believe, either Marker and Herndon from the 1950s or Medina, Miller, and Jones, which are more recent, because the government insists the terminal element is implied, but they offer no explanation for what manner it would be implied. That is, are both prejudice and service discredit implied? And if they are they implied in the conjunctive or disjunctive? Or do they get to pick at some point what is implied in the specification? And this dilemma highlights how an accused cannot be put on notice of the theory of criminality that the government's pursuing unless it's expressly alleged in the specification.
Or leaving three out of it, leaving crimes not capital out of it. Are one and two separate offenses?
Separate offenses, Your Honor?
Right.
Could he be charged with both?
Well, is service discrediting conduct and conduct that prejudices of good order and discipline, are they separate offenses?
No,
if X does act something that's alleged in the spec, and it is service discrediting, or it is conduct to prejudice of good order and discipline.
Or just one or the other, depending on how the government pleads.
Are they interchangeable? Are they different? What are they?
They're alternative theories of liability, Your Honor, that the government can pursue.
And can they pursue both at once?
They can pursue both at once.
Well, doesn't that kind of undercut your argument that you need to state it explicitly?
No, Your Honor, because if they charge it, if they expressly allege in the disjunctive, or... that clearly puts the accused on notice that they're pursuing.
Okay, you're saying that their alternative theory is a liability, and the government can charge both of them or either of them as long as they do it explicitly.
Yes, Your Honor, and they could even charge it as and then they would just be burdening themselves.
Okay.
Counsel, just so that I'm clear on what it is that you're not arguing, as I understand your brief, you're not taking issue that with Article 134 is a constitutional offense, correct?
No, Your Honor.
And you're not taking issue with the ability of the President to delineate ways in which Article 134 can be violated?
No, Your Honor, that embraces our argument.
So if I'm understanding, what you are taking issue with is the President's discussion, which says that the element doesn't need to be alleged.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we really don't have any idea why that's even there or what prompted that language. But although that type of discussion is persuasive authority of this Court, it's not binding. And once it becomes unpersuasive, this Court shouldn't follow it. Certainly when you juxtapose this Court's holdings in Medina Miller and Jones with the Supreme Court precedent cited in our brief, there's simply no reason to follow that language. Simply put, it cannot. Because this Court said in Medina Miller Jones, an accused has a right to know under what legal theory he may be convicted. And the Supreme Court said the same thing in Russell. Over there they said that the government cannot be left free to roam and shift its theory of criminality throughout a trial. And that's exactly what happened here.
Okay, counsel, you're asking us to overrule a number of precedents on constitution and hold on constitution. Let me make sure I know what you're asking.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're asking for us to rule on constitutional grounds that it needs to be explicitly alleged.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If we do what you want us to do, what is to protect this Court against, of course, number one, under Georgetown v. Kentucky, presumably pending cases will get the benefit of that change in the law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What is to keep us from getting 1,000 quorum nobis petitions dating back to 1951 under the guise of Donato saying it wasn't explicitly alleged and this is a continuing part of the procedure and do something?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, Lascaux v. Foster doesn't want this Court to look to those problems, if there are any. He's more focused on this case, obviously. We think it's a prospective rule that anyone on direct appeal would get the benefit of
Correct.
This new rule. And if there are those problems, Your Honor, maybe I should do more about that to give you a better answer, but I just don't know. But it shouldn't really be a concern for this Court whether or not to change a rule that is required to be changed under Supreme Court precedent. So,
fiat justitia ruat coelum. Let justice be done, although the heavens fall.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, do cases in which direct review are completed get the benefit of a rule in this case?
No, Your Honor. Our position would be that they would not.
And so if they would not,
there would be no issue.
Thank you.
I'm confused by your position. You just said to Judge over here that the element has to be expressly alleged.
Yes, sir.
And I thought you took the position earlier that 307 was sound law.
It is, Your Honor.
Is your position expressly alleged or necessarily implied, or is your position expressly stated full stop?
Your Honor, the important distinction is that, first of all, RCM 307 is good law. An element may be necessarily implied, but the key language is
in the context of 134.
Yes, Your Honor.
Putting aside whether your specification does that.
No, actually, in 134, it would not work, sir.
It never worked.
It would never work because if you express the alleged determinant element, the notion of necessary implication.
So your position isn't. So your position is that with respect to Article 134, 307 is not sound law.
It doesn't work there. That's correct, Your Honor. But that doesn't mean we're not saying that RCM 307 should be changed. We're just saying it doesn't apply to 134. It applies to attempt cases. It would apply to fraud. It would apply where an accused was charged with escaping and they didn't put in the. They didn't state that
so your position is RCM 307 is good law, depending on the offense, and you'll tell us what the offense is in the case-specific context.
Well, we have guidance on what cases that would be good law, Your Honor, it would work. It would work in circumstances found in Resendez-Pons. It would work in circumstances found in the Second Ninth Circuit, Klein and Whitman. That's where it works, and it's actually a very precise rule. Look to a word and see if its meaning encompasses.
I get it. You're express except in a Ponce type situation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, let's take the specification that was alleged in Parker against Levy under Article 134. And after describing the place, it said, with design to promote disloyalty and disaffection among the troops, publicly utter the following statements to diverse enlisted personnel at diverse times. And then it goes on to describe the statement. Now, if that specification had not specifically said to the prejudice of good order and discipline, why would that not be by necessary implication when the offense said with design to promote disloyalty and disaffection among the troops?
It's a closer case there, Your Honor. We see that, but...
Well, and why wouldn't a specification that said did commit adultery in a way that injured the reputation of the service, why wouldn't that imply the element of nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces? I mean, I understand...
Can you use the language you said that would imply it is the nature to do
that? That it was to injure the reputation of the service. I mean, why wouldn't that imply the nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces? I mean, I understand that what I understand your argument is that the mere act itself doesn't mean that the other element is implied. But I don't know that you need to take that argument as far as you're taking it, which is to say 307 can't be satisfied in any way.
Yes, Your Honor. Maybe I didn't go further enough into answering that Article 307 question.
Or maybe you went too far.
We're not saying simply that under the circumstances you gave, that language, it's not so much that it implies the terminal element. I mean, that's what it means. And
well, isn't that what imply means? Is it means that it doesn't just state, it doesn't repeat
yes,
the element precisely, but it means it or necessarily implies it. Isn't that what necessarily implies means?
Yes, Your Honor, and we're not going to... We certainly won't disagree with that.
If the element is using force against that other person, if the specification said, you know, did have sex with the person by beating them repeatedly over the head, don't you think that that element would necessarily be implied?
If they simply changed the language to use different words that meant the same thing, then we would agree that that element was necessarily implied. Actually, what we would say is that it was expressly alleged. If you're just replacing words that have the same meaning, you're hardly implying anything. Although I know that in Resendez-Pons, and the distinction they're trying to make there, though, is that attempt is a statutory element, and the overt act was a common law element. So in order to find it there, they found it certainly, and we agree that attempt means an overt act. We see no word in the specification here that means prejudice or good order, discipline, or services credit. And I see I'm almost out of time. If I could just conclude with this point.
I have one more question.
Why don't you take Judge Stuckey's question and then offer a concluding point, and then you have a further opportunity on rebuttal unless there are other questions.
My question is, this is a contested case. Would it make any difference if it were a guilty plea?
No, Your Honor.
It would not. Thank you.
My last point, Your Honors, in
well, I have a question in light of that question. Is your answer to Judge Stuckey's question predicated on your view that this is structural error?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we disagree with you that it was structural error and thought that it was tested for plain error with respect to prejudice, do you think that it would make a difference whether it was a guilty plea?
You're talking just about the terminal element, Your Honor.
And if there was a guilty plea to the case and there was a pretrial agreement that agreed with them pleading guilty to the specification as alleged, don't you think those are factors that we could take into account in a prejudice analysis if we disagree with you that this was structural error? I mean, isn't that what we've just held in recent cases after Jones?
Yes, Your Honor, but that would be a monumental shift in this court's precedent, that where an element is missing from a specification, the specification is fatally defective.
What about the Supreme Court's decision in Nieder? Didn't the Supreme Court, my recollection is that in Nieder, the Supreme Court dealt with the element of materiality in a false, I believe it was a false statement type of case, and the Supreme Court said since that wasn't at issue in that particular case in terms of being contested by the parties, that the error wasn't prejudicial and not specifically dealing with it.
And if I recall, Your Honor, I think that the critical distinction there is in either the materiality aspect, again, was a common law element. Where here we're talking about a statutory element, which is...
I don't think there are any common law federal crimes, are there?
Yeah, maybe I have to look back at Nieder, Your Honor, again. But we still believe that if this court is going to test for prejudice, where a specification is missing an element of defense, then it's going to change all of the cases, all of its case precedents, saying that it doesn't test for prejudice in those circumstances.
You'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, may it please the court, I'm Captain Sam Warren. I represent the United States in this case. The word is wrongful. When used under a charge 134 and alleged as wrongful in accordance with the theory that is alleged, which is adultery in this case, the specification necessarily implies the terminal element. The specification states an offense if it does three things. If it expressly, if it alleges the elements of the offense expressly or by implication, if it provides notice of the offense to the accused, and it protects the accused from double jeopardy. For 60 years, this court has held that an Article 134 offense that does not expressly allege the terminal element states an offense and meets this test because the terminal element is necessarily implied. These holdings remain good law because they're in line with Supreme Court precedent, they're in line with the President's directives and direction on this specification and under this charge, and they're in line with historical precedent which informed the statute. First,
Counsel, you referenced the President's directives, and in your brief, you assert that the President has the authority under Article 36 to promulgate the rule that appears in Part 4 of the manual. Now, our court has repeatedly held that the President doesn't have that authority under Article 36, starting with Ellis against Jacob, Mitchell, Davis, Chechen. So is it the government's position that we have to overrule all those cases in order to uphold the precedent and not overrule Marker in those cases?
No, Your Honor. What the President's rules do in this case is they provide notice under the Sixth Amendment analysis to the accused along with...
I'd like you just to address the Article 36 issue, which you have in your brief. Where in Article 36 does the President have any authority to interpret and give binding guidance on substantive offenses?
He has rulemaking authority, Your Honor, but he does not have the authority to change the substantive offense or to make a criminal statute or anything along those lines. And if the government's brief alludes to that or mentions that in any way, it is incorrect, Your Honor.
Thank you.
He certainly has rulemaking authority under this case, but he doesn't.
Are you saying that the provisions in the manual amount to constitutional notice? Does one have to go beyond the words of the statute? That's kind of an innovation, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. Specifically in this case, if we look at it to make
it... It is an innovation.
Yes, Your Honor. Only the President could...
What authority is there for the proposition that an administrative rule, which is what the manual is, can constitute constitutional notice for the purposes of a criminal statute?
The administrative rule which the President promulgated is persuasive authority that should be viewed in light of this Court's precedent.
That's not my question.
Isn't that precisely the proposition that the majority of this Court rejected in the United States versus Jones Counsel? That specific
idea. If it does not comply, at the end of the day, if the President's rule does not comply with the Sixth Amendment notice provision, then it cannot overcome that constitutional requirement.
And did we say in Jones that the fact that the President said that something was an LIO and the elements were not in fact LIOs was not sufficient notice?
That's a limit.
And from that proposition, how do you find support for the proposition that if the President says you don't need to allege an element at all, that that's okay?
That alone is not okay, Your Honor. It is.
But that's exactly the proposition that you're asking us to agree to, which seems to be directly at odds with the concept that we've developed from Medina to Miller to Jones, that in fact the elements need to be alleged in the specification.
The government's reading of those cases is that notice is required, which is certainly the case. I mean, that is in line with Supreme Court precedent. Notice is required, and that is the test.
Well, and in addition to that, the concept that, the terminal elements of Article 134 are not to be implied by the fact of the act alone, okay? And so if we were to agree with your position here, which is that the fact that they said that he wrongfully had sex with a person that wasn't his wife, that that necessarily implies the terminal elements, how do you square that with Medina, Jones, or Miller? Because under that analysis, it would have been perfectly fine in Miller that the CCA wrote in the terminal elements. We would have just said it didn't matter that they lined out the clause 3 and that the other things were surplusage.
There's two issues at play that distinguish that line of cases, Your Honor. First is the Fifth Amendment due process requirement that every element goes to the members, to the trier of fact, and is determined beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the reason why, in a case where, say, the members only convict on an Article 120 offense, they never consider a terminal element. And if the Court of Criminal Appeals then affirms on a lesser included offense, which also includes that terminal element, that element did not go to the members, according to this Court's holding in that line of cases. This is different. The terminal element here did go to the members, and they did find it beyond a reasonable doubt. So that Fifth Amendment due process requirement
but
is satisfied.
While this Court disagreed in our most recent cases as to whether a case was an LIO in a particular case, every member of this Court agreed that there's a due process right within the military justice system to have the elements put in the specification for them to be put in the charge sheet. Now, I understand that in your very interesting request for reconsideration in McMurrin that you take issue with that, which is fine. But that's what the holding of this court is.
Yes, Your Honor. In line with the Supreme Court precedent, that holding requires that the charge, or in this case the specification, contains every element, either expressly or by implication. That is what the court is
telling. And so what language is it in this specification that you're saying implies the terminal element of either prejudicial to the good order and discipline or service discrediting? And wouldn't you agree that your case would be an easier case to make if there was only one terminal element, but there's two, and neither are alleged?
There's two theories of criminality, yes, Your Honor.
And how is that any different from a rape charge where there's multiple ways in which someone could be raped? And if you alleged one, I don't think that you would say that it necessarily implied another.
Correct, Your Honor. In this case specifically, firstly, as the Supreme Court held, Article 134 must be viewed in its historical context.
But the historical context has nothing to do with alleging the elements of the offense. It has to do with the whether or not it's constitutionally overbroad because it's vague. And they said no, viewed in its historical context, it's not. That has nothing to do with charging.
And as the Supreme Court held in Resendez-Ponce, Your Honor, the historical context of the charging of the indictment in that case, which the indictment clause obviously is not applicable here, but as the indictment that was satisfied there, they looked at the historical context of how that had been alleged. Historical context is not alone sufficient. That's not what the government was arguing here. But when combined with an offense that is specifically under a 134 charge, which also distinguishes this case from the Miller, Benita, Jones line of cases, the accused is specifically identified as a charge 134 offense. When combined with the language of the specification, which is in line with the president's, one of the president's specifically listed ways that the offense may be violated. So once again, he's not creating law, but it is in accordance with.
Well, wait a minute. Now we're back to my question again, which you didn't really answer, which is how can an administrative provision provide constitutional notice of criminal statute?
That alone is not, the government is not relying on that.
Okay, it can't.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
Where are we?
In this case, in the specification, the adultery specification we have here, we have three things. We have that it was alleged as a charge 134 offense. We have the word wrongfully, wrongful, which is the word that necessarily implies the terminal element when it is falsified.
Counsel, let me ask you a question about that. Would your position be different if the word wrongfully were not used in this case?
You'd have to apply the same the same test for whether specification states an offense, but under this offense, it would certainly be weaker. The notice provision, you know, whether notice was satisfied would be weaker in this case, Your Honor, if that word is not used.
So your better argument is that the term wrongfully implies the terminal offense, the terminal elements. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, let's take a look then at the elements of 134 adultery in the manual. And the first element is wrongfully, but then the third element is the terminal elements. So how can one element imply a completely separate element that isn't stated. I mean, it's stating an element that is in the manual.
That's right.
Okay, and there's no argument about that. But then why would that necessarily imply the other elements?
What makes this conduct wrongful and therefore criminal is the terminal element. What makes the adultery, what takes it out of the civilian world and makes it subject to the UCMJ and makes it subject to criminal sanction here is the fact that it is wrongful and wrongfully criminal, essentially.
And why? And why is that? Why is it wrongful?
Because it violates the terminal element, which is that it is prejudicial to good order and discipline.
So then in the manual, really, the first element that they list, which is wrongful, in your view, does nothing more than refer to the third element, which is the terminal element. It is surplusage, in other words.
As alleged in this specification, Your Honor, that yes. As the wrongfully is used in this specification, it is wrongful because it violates the terminal element.
Is the date important as well, or just the word wrongful that does all the work you need?
The date and the time, place, and all the other descriptive factors go to one, that provide notice of the theory of the offense, and they provide the necessary Sixth Amendment notice that is required.
As a matter of legal policy, why not just allege the terminal elements? Why is this so important?
The government's
I'm not asking you to concede your case, but I'm asking why haggle over this stuff in any event?
The government, a prosecutor in any case, could certainly add the language of the terminal element that is prejudicial, good order, and discipline, or service discrediting. But as this court noted in United States v. Marker, the inclusion of that element cannot make what is not criminal conduct criminal alone, and they cannot make criminal conduct, the omission of it in the specification, cannot detract from it either.
Is there any argument why it would not be best practices, putting aside whether it's legally required, not to include it?
In terms of best practices, the government is not arguing that that issue, Your Honor, that, or that it would be difficult to do so.
I mean, and you don't disagree, counsel, do you, that that prejudicial to good order and discipline and services crediting are two different things, without disputing the fact that the same conduct could be both. Those two concepts are distinct, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Two different theories of liability.
And why, whether you think it's constitutionally required or not, wouldn't it be a better practice to allege which one of those things it was, either or both? I mean, particularly where, as in this case, an accused objected to the specification.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's fatally deficient. Why in a case like that, in light of the cases that have been coming out of this court, wouldn't the government withdraw the charge and re-prefer it correctly?
The reason it states an offense and the reason it satisfies the Sixth Amendment is because...
That's not my question.
But to answer your question, Your Honor, the inclusion of those words on this specification would add no greater notice to the accused than he had based on what was on the charge sheet. He is on notice based on the charge, based on the use of wrongful, and based on
I could respond to that with an expletive, but that would not be appropriate. So instead, I'll simply say, how is it not the case that they were not put on notice as to whether the government was pursuing a theory that this conduct was prejudicial to good order and discipline, or whether the government was going to pursue the theory that this was sort of discrediting conduct, or both, from the charge sheet?
Based on the charge sheet and based on the language...
Or they should intuit that they were implied, which is directly what Miller said was not allowed anymore.
Yes, Sharon, but Miller was a different case where it's dealing with a different... greater offense that is not fall under Article 134.
But the theory, the principle, counsel,
yes, Your Honor,
is the same. I mean, you can say, well, that was a case about trains, and this is a case about cars. But if the principle applies to trains and cars, you can't distinguish the case on that basis.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the basis, the important basis to that case, as in Resendez Ponce, and as in Hamlin and Russell and every Supreme Court precedent, and the cases this Court considered, the key test is, are the Sixth Amendment notice requirements met? And if the Sixth Amendment notice requirements are met, then it states an offense, and that is the test that was laid out at the beginning. Does it state an offense with the elements expressly or implicitly alleged? Is he on notice of the charge that he must defend against, and is he protected from double jeopardy? That is the test, and that is why under different factors and different allegations of the charge matter. they provide different notice to the accused. And when he's under charge 134, which the Supreme Court has said must be viewed in its historical context, and when it involves the word wrongful, and when it involves a specification of an element, specification of theory that is in line with the president's, one of his listed elements, and in light of this court's custom and usage, and even predating the UCMJ, the way the UCMJ was, the prejudicial libidor and discipline of service creating offense was alleged prior to that, the terminal element was not included.
Let's try the question that was asked before again. Putting aside the constitutional issue, whether this is required or not, Medina and Miller are 2008 and 2009 cases. What possible reason would there be for the president not providing clarifying guidance in the manual for courts martial as to allegation of those terminal elements in any specification? And what reason would there be for a judge who has the case in which an objection is made by the accused not saying, let's put those elements in there? What reason would there be for not doing it? I understand all your arguments as to why it may not be constitutionally required, why there may be a necessary implication, but I'm a little baffled as to why this is an appellate issue.
As a matter of best practices, Your Honor, it could certainly be done. And a judge could certainly say, let's amend the charge sheet, let's add that on. As a matter of best practices, a trial counsel could certainly allege that terminal element on the charge sheet. As a matter of best practice, that could absolutely be addressed.
And in fact, the government cites Parker against Levy for the theory that it's not required, citing footnote 6 in Parker against Levy, which discusses Article 133.
Yes, Your Honor.
But footnote 5 in Parker against Levy cites the Article 134 charge in which the words prejudicial to good order and discipline were expressly placed.
Absolutely.
In that case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it, as a matter of best practices, it can be done, but it is not what is required.
But, I mean, both your brief and the CCA's decision, you know, place great reliance on Parker versus Levy as though it is standing for the proposition that somehow the historical necessity for a tool for commanders to have fluid ability to create offenses to serve the needs of good order and discipline within their command necessarily supports the proposition that you don't need to allege the elements of the offense. And I don't see where and what in that opinion you're relying on. I think it's rather disingenuous, actually.
The government is citing Parker for the proposition that Article 134 offense must be viewed in its historical context.
But the historical context is the one that I just described, not the principle that you would like us, that you would like to subscribe to it.
That it must be viewed in its historical context is solely for the defense of how has it been alleged, as the Supreme Court did in this class when they reviewed the attempt indictment. They said, in its historical context, how has this been done? And as a result of how it has been done, is the accused necessarily, in that case, the defendant necessarily on notice of the elements that he must defend against? That is the only proposition the government decided Parker v. Levy for.
You're posing an awful lot of, the word wrongfully is carrying an awful lot of freight here. In your argument, say you had a prosecution not under 134, but for a violation of the law of war, you know, shooting prisoners or something, and you allege that he wrongfully killed prisoners. That doesn't, you're seeming to imply 134 in there, but you know you can prosecute under the law of war without fitting it under an article. So where are we in a situation like that?
In every case you have, there is no bright line rule, and that is what the Supreme Court held, and that's why the merely following the language of the statute, for instance, as the Supreme Court addressed in Russell, may not be sufficient. Merely, it is a case-by-case. You look and you see, is notice provided? One of the issues that's looked at, in addition to the charge in this case and the use of wrongfully, is the historic custom and usage and practice of that offense. And so if in that case where you're dealing with the law of war, if you had all of those elements in place where it was alleged as a charge 134, and if it was...
No, I'm saying it's not charged as 134.
Then if you
it's charged a violation of the laws and customs of war, separate and apart from any enumerated article or 134.
If you had the same issues in place where it is...
I mean, that may not happen because there's such an impetus to shove it under an enumerated article.
Yes, sir.
But the code is clear that it covers violations of laws and customs of war.
It's the same analysis, Your Honor. Whether we're looking at an Article 120 offense or an Article 134 offense or a federal offense in the Supreme Court, looking at the indictment clause in the Fifth Amendment, and Sixth Amendment, due process and notice provisions, the same test applies. Is he accused on notice of the charge that he must defend against? Are the elements expressly or implicitly alleged? And you look and there's no bright line, A plus, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 2 test. It is looking at the totality, looking at the custom and usage and historical practice, looking at the words that are in the specification, looking at it as a whole, is the accused on notice? And as a whole in this specification, with the charge, with the use of the word wrongfully, with the historic custom and usage, the accused is on notice of the charge that he must defend against.
One more question. Would it make any difference if this were a guilty plea?
The same analysis would have to apply. I mean, whether there was there would be no Sixth Amendment question, whether there would be a known and voluntary question, I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Counsel, as a matter of best practices, while the government is awaiting this court's decision in this particular case, I would urge the government, rather than continuing to create appellate issues, to at least consider giving some guidance to the field as to the best practices in these cases.
Yes, Your Honor, the government has, and the government will continue to do so. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're going to argue best practices is to not do it? Right, okay.
No, Your Honor. What I'd like to talk about is the circumstances which make an Article 134 conduct criminal. We have the act and we have the terminal element, but really the most important aspect, for an accused anyway, are what are the circumstances that made that conduct criminal?
And where in this case did the defense ask for any relief in that regard? My reading, and perhaps it may be not correct, is that all the defense asked for would be for the charge to state that it was either service discrediting or conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline.
Yes, Your Honor. Because this court held in Miller that under the circumstances was part of the terminal element, it has to be expressly alleged, point one. And because under Russell versus United States, the court said there that where the statutory language used is of a generic nature, that the charge must do more than simply parrot that generic language.
So your argument now is different from the argument that was made at trial. That is, your argument now is that it would have been insufficient for the charge to have said what it said and adding the words at the end, and such conduct was prejudicial to good order and discipline.
Yes, Your Honor. We think that the notice deficiency here is greater than simply the term element being prejudiced and service discredit not being alleged.
Why isn't the opportunity to request a bill of particulars sufficient?
The reason is, Your Honor, is because the statutory language here has to be found in the specification of the Supreme Court precedent. And this court found in Miller that under the circumstances was part of that. And just as a practical matter, in terms of notice, the accused is reading this charge sheet. Lance Corporal Foster is reading this charge sheet, and it looks to him like the game is caught. He committed adultery, and therefore he's committed a crime. We know that's not the case, but more specifically, the question for him is, if he knows the terminal element exists, that, for instance, the government is pursuing a theory that his conduct is prejudice, good order, discipline, the question he has to ask himself, and that he needs to know in order to defend against it, is why. Is the government going to bring into the courtroom the first sergeant and say that the unit's morale has been eroded? Because if they are, then he can go out and get his fellow Lance corporals or someone else to say, no, there's been no effect whatsoever.
Well, now you're making a much broader argument than you made either at trial or in the appellate brief, or that Medina or Miller or Jones supports, which is all those cases stand for is a proposition that the elements have to be alleged in the charge sheet. And now you're making a broader argument that that's not good enough.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why don't you confine yourself to what the issue that we granted and the issue that you argued below?
With respect, Your Honor, that argument was specifically found in our brief. And we'll certainly back off of it if the court's not interested in hearing about it or asking questions about it. But we do think, under Russell, that it's required I mean, it just makes this specification even all the more deficient.
And what case stands for the proposition that an act of adultery without anything further would not be a valid charge under Article 134?
Jones, Your Honor, where the...
So that Jones stands for the proposition that if the charge says committed an act of sexual intercourse with a person not an honest wife on such and such a date to the prejudice of good order and discipline, your view is that that's a deficient charge.
We think that there would be notice deficiency, Your Honor. Perhaps all we're asking...
What about substantive deficiency? Is that what case stands for the proposition that an act of adultery is not prejudicial to good order and discipline?
It's not, Your Honor?
Yeah. What case stands for the proposition that that alone wouldn't be sufficient for it to sustain a conviction?
We just rely on the statutory language, Your Honor.
And what language in Jones are you relying on for your argument that it stands for the proposition that the specification that the Chief Judge just gave you would be deficient?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What we would rely on is Russell in that case. Supreme Court's holding in Russell says you can't just parrot the generic language. You have to descend to particulars.
Have to allege, since there's no statute prohibiting adultery in the armed forces, would they have to allege explicitly that it violates a custom of the service?
No, Your Honor. We think, simply putting, that the conduct was prejudicial good order and discipline because it eroded the morale of the unit would be enough if the accused at that point wanted more than they could ask for a bill of particulars. And if I may sum up, Your Honor, I would simply say that we're not asking anything onerous of the government here. Simply asking that they track the language of the charging statute and they put enough facts in the specification so an accused knows what he has to defend against when he comes to trial. Not only is this fair, but it is required under this court's precedents and the precedents of the Supreme Court. If no further questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, counsel. We gave the defense a bit more time, and my sense was the government had completed its argument, but I wanted to give the government an opportunity, if it had anything further to say, to do so. Thank you. We thank both parties for your presentation. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Court stands in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow.